I heard you say over and over again throughout this whole conversation that when you sleep better, you heal better.
Absolutely. There's help. There's help. And the body is amazing. The body can heal. I've known this from personal experience. And even to this day, I notice improvement as I healed. And my brain injury was, you know, back in 98. And I still think that I'm still healing. Sleep is part of that big equation. But there's hope.
There is always hope. And you are not alone.
Hi, I'm Christabel Braden, and this is my brain injury podcast, Hope Survives. Here, we share information, education, and support for the brain injury community. This is an uplifting podcast to bring hope to your darkest days. As a survivor of traumatic brain injury and multiple concussions, I know what it's like to struggle to find hope. I don't want anyone to feel as alone as I did. And that's why I started my online community called Hope After Head Injury. This podcast is an extension of that, and I'd love to invite you to join along as we explore the realities of life with brain injury, with messages of encouragement, interviews with doctors and professionals, and survivor stories. No matter where you're at on your journey, there is always hope.
With a little hope, you can make
Welcome back to Hope Survives Podcast. We're here today for part two of the conversation with Dr. Roy Wilkins. Dr. Wilkins is an expert in sleep medicine. He has his DC, his MD. He has been trained in neurology, chiropractic medicine, and sleep medicine. And he's also a TBI survivor. So if you heard last week's episode 48, Dr. Wilkins shares some of his experience with TBI, as well as kind of an introduction into brain health and why sleep is so important and what are some sleep disturbances that can happen after brain injury. Now, today we're getting into some of the specifics on how to get to the root cause of sleep issues, identifying, you know, what your problem is. Is it falling asleep? Is it staying asleep? You know, what is going on? He also talks about sleep studies. What is a sleep study? What will it look like? How will it help? He talks about sleep hygiene and habits and hope that there's help available. So I hope that this episode is helpful to you. I heard from a number of you last week that we left you on a cliffhanger. So thanks for waiting around for the second half of that conversation. That's the first time that I've done that. But those of us with brain injuries, I just thought it would be better for a longer conversation instead of giving you a whole hour at once, giving us, you know, shorter, I mean, these episodes are not short, but giving it to us in two parts. And so if you like the two parts, let me know. If you would prefer one big long episode, let me know that as well, as I try to make the podcast the best it can possibly be for you. So thanks so much for being here. Thanks for listening. And let's get started. I started Hope After Head Injury 10 years ago, and it has grown into a global online support community. You can get involved and check out more of the online resources we have available at hopeafterheadinjury.com. Connect with survivors, caregivers, and family members through our Zoom meetings, our Facebook support group, or the Brain Injury Bible Study group. I remember what it's like to feel so alone with brain injury, and my goal with these groups is for you to know that you are not alone and to be able to connect with others going through similar circumstances. We are in this together. Now, I want to thank you for listening to the podcast and remind you that this podcast is for education and informational purposes only and not intended for medical advice. If you need specific medical advice, please consult your physician. Now, thanks for listening, and let's get on with the show.
If there is a problem with sleep, there's probably some other sort of root cause is what I'm hearing. So yes. Not everyone's going to have the same cause, but they might have this. No. They might all say they have trouble sleeping, but they yes. might all have different reasons behind it. And so it's really important to find why you specifically are having trouble sleeping.
I know intuitively now the American Psychiatric Association and things like that, they don't categorize them like this. But in sleep medicine, what I like to do is I like to categorize patients that don't sleep very good. I want to find out is, do you have a hard time falling asleep or do you have a hard time staying asleep? And to me, that speaks volumes. If you're having a hard time falling asleep, I know one of a couple of things is going on. Number one, your circadian cycle may not, or your sleep-wake cycle may not be in sync. In other words, you're trying to go to sleep at the wrong time. You don't fall asleep until 1 or 2 o'clock, but yet you're going to bed at 9. And you're just going to sit there for 2-3 hours counting sheep. And it's just not going to work. So that's one thing. The other thing that when we see sleep onset insomnia, oftentimes there is an associated, if you will, psychiatric or psychological problem. It's not uncommon to have anxiety. People can't turn their mind off. And so when they tell me that they have sleep onset insomnia, I go, okay, what does your mind do when you go to bed? Oh my gosh, I'm just rehearsing. My mind's just going a million miles a minute. I can't turn it off. So one of the little tricks that I like to do, I mean, yeah, you could say datum and stuff and try to do that, but we like to take their mind off things. Generally speaking, we don't do this for everybody, but one of the little tricks that I like to do is say, hey, if you can't wind your mind down, I need your mind focused on something else. We distract them. Now, that distraction can be a TV. So put a TV on in your bedroom and watch a program. Now, granted, that's not good for our sleep-wake cycle in that it affects our circadian cycle. But what it does is it distracts them. And if they're going to do that, they have to have a timer on their TV. And so usually what happens is these patients, they'll need maybe an hour or so. And so if they put their TV on and they put a sleep timer on it, if they're watching a show and the more boring the show is, or the more they get involved, kind of you can look at it as one of two ways, it distracts their minds. And so instead of them thinking about the processes of the day, or Johnny did this to me, or Mabel said this to me, or this happened or that happened, and all the drama that people go through, we get away from that and we just kind of let their minds just kind of vegetate and just kind of go, you know, just go into la la land. And so that's one of the little tricks.
Would a podcast or an audiobook do something similar?
Yeah, audiobooks. That's great. I was just going to mention that.
Yeah.
Audiobooks are good. Some people, reading does that. For me, if I want to go to sleep and I'm not, oh my gosh, I start reading when it's time to go to bed and I start reading, I'm going to like, ugh. And pretty soon I'm going to zonk out really quick. Not all people are like that. Some people, when they read, it keeps them up. But audiobooks, music, hearing the ocean, hearing the rain. I know for myself, when it rains and it's storming, I sleep like a baby. I can sleep through a storm. It's great. I like it. But that's just me. And so everybody is a little bit different. So that's one of the little tricks that we use. If they're waking up in the early morning hours, then we start thinking about things like some type of either psychiatric problem or maybe a sleep disorder breathing problem. And so we start, you know, when you wake up in after 2-3 hours, what time of the night do you wake up? Are you having a nightmare? Are you sleepwalking and then you wake up? You know, what's going on? And so that kind of helps kind of guide us which direction we need to go. Invariably, patients that have sleep disorder breathing, like sleep apnea, they go to sleep and every time they have an apneic episode, they actually wake up. Now, and they have what we call an arousal. And arousals usually last for about 15 seconds. And most of the time, people don't even remember those. If they're short arousals from sleep, you're totally amnestic of them. You don't remember them at all. But if it's the longer arousals that you remember longer, that you remember the best when you're awake for longer. I always tell this story when I'm teaching, and this is such a classic story. The very first study that I ever did years and years ago was a veteran, and he complained of, he said, I don't have trouble falling asleep. He said, I can't stay asleep. And anyway, so I did a sleep study on him, and I asked him in the morning, how many times did you wake up? And he said, I woke up 3 times. I said, really? And I just laughed. And he goes, why are you laughing? You know, that's kind of a rude thing to do. But I said, no, you woke up 300 times last night. 300 times. And he goes, I did? I said, yes. He had no clue. He had no clue. And remember, when we talked about the autonomics, every time you wake up from an apneic episode, if you will, there's a sympathetic barrage that makes the heart go boom, 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 makes you break out in a sweat, you know, raises your blood pressure and all this sort of stuff. And can you imagine doing that hundreds of times a night? What do you think the consequences are going to be the next day? What do you think you're going to feel like? Number one, you're not going to feel like you had a very good night's sleep to begin with. And number two, you're going to affect basically every system of the body. You're going to affect your cardiovascular system. You're going to affect your endocrine system. You're going to affect your gastrointestinal system. You can affect your nervous system. You're going to show effects in every part of your body. And so those things have to be addressed. Are they psychiatric? And if they're psychiatric, I remember when I was in medical school and I remember doing a psych rotation. And the psychiatrist, one of the things she had me do is I would go in and I would evaluate the patient first. I would, you know, talk to him and do a physical on him. And then I would write up my little thing. And then I'd come back and show the psychiatrist and she would say, yay or nay, or, you know, yes, this is good. And she gave me some really good advice. She said, Dr. Wilkins, she said, when you have a psychiatric problem, the first thing that's going to change before a psychiatric episode or a depressive episode or an anxiety episode, an affective episode, he said, the first thing that you're going to see is a change in their sleep patterns. And I go, really? And she goes, yes, that's going to show up first. You'll see that first. Their sleep patterns are going to change. And when you see that, then you start keying in on those key questionnaires that, you know, the key questions that we need to ask. And I found that to really be helpful advice. And so that's one of the things that we have to do. Now, the irony of it is that oftentimes, if you can get them back to sleep, oftentimes the psychiatric disorder or the psychological disorder improves or may even go away on its own. Now, sometimes it doesn't, you know, and I don't mean to say that there's no need to ever see a psychologist or psychiatrist. That's not true. Yeah, sometimes you have to. But if we can sleep, these things can go away. You know, in traumatic brain injury, you know, who do they usually see? Initially for pain, you're going to see, you know, the family doctor, the internist, whatever, they may send you to a pain specialist, blah, blah, blah. But when these things persist, who do they start sending you to? Psychiatry, or maybe some sort of neurology. And that's typically the route that they go to. And it's, don't get me wrong, these doctors, they're doing the best that they can. And this is how they've been trained. Medical physicians are trained to give pharmaceuticals. And sometimes that works, but you know, that's what they're trained to do. And sometimes that may not be the best thing. Sometimes there's other things that can either complement that, or we can even do without that. But that's how they're trained. And no offense to medical physicians, that's how they're trained. They're good people. They're trying to do the best that they can. It's just that they're taught a certain bias. And that's what's so cool about sleep medicine, is that we realize that if you don't sleep, it affects all these other areas. And let's get them to sleep. And sometimes these things will just kind of take care of themselves. And that's what's so cool about my job.
That's so great. Thanks for sharing. And you were trained as in neurology?
I was.
You have an MD, right?
Well, I'm an MD and I'm a DC.
Okay.
I'm a chiropractic neurologist by training. Yeah. I don't practice medicine. I practice chiropractic medicine, if you will. Mm-hmm. I practice sleep medicine. That's all I do.
Yeah.
The majority of my time, I'm looking at sleep studies and I am writing a report and giving recommendations. And so because they're not my patients, these are patients that have been sent to us. And so I'm sending these patients back to their referring provider and saying, okay, this is what we need to do.
That's
you need to get them this device, or we need to do this, or you need to send them over and do this. And so that's my job. That's what I do.
So for our listeners, you'd probably recommend, if they are having trouble with sleep, to get some sort of sleep study or to see a sleep medicine doctor.
Yeah, you do. Sleep medicine doctors there's not enough of them around. So usually the first route is you see your primary care practitioner, whether that's a PA, a chiropractor, an MD, a DO, family doctor, you know, whatever. And you talk to them and you tell them, I'm having trouble sleeping. And they may ask a few questions, and because they want to know, is this psychiatric related or is this related to something else? There are certain, for example, insomnia by itself is not a good enough indication to get a sleep study. You have to have something else. Like, do you snore? Do you get up at night to go to the bathroom? Do you have head and neck sweats? Do you wake up gasping or choking? Do you have morning headaches? If you've had those things, then yeah, let's get a sleep study.
I think morning headaches would definitely be something that a lot of brain injury survivors can relate to. I know for me, there'll be days I would just wake up in pain before I open my eyes.
Absolutely. So we do that, and then we'll do the sleep study. And the parameters that we're looking at on the sleep study is, first of all, we're looking at the brain waves. Now, so we're looking at an EEG. Now, in sleep medicine, the EEGs that we do are a shotgun approach EEG. They're a screen. We're not looking at every part of the brain. We're specifically, usually we have a couple of electrodes centrally, a couple of electrodes frontally, and a couple of electrodes occipitally. Usually, unless we suspect a seizure disorder or something like that, we usually don't put electrodes on the temporal lobes or anything like that. But we're looking at sleep, and we want to identify sleep. How long does it take you to fall asleep? How long do you stay asleep? And what stages of sleep do you go into? And that tells us volumes about your health. For example, patients who are sleep deprived will do a couple of different things. Number one, they have a hard time going into slow wave sleep. Okay. Number two, they stay in light sleep, which is, if you're in light sleep, that's stage one or stage two sleep, it's easy to be aroused. It doesn't take so much to wake you up. You hear a car outside that wakes you up. someone slams the door, that wakes you up. You hear a TV in the other room, that wakes you up. And so in light sleep, we're going to see that type of thing. The other thing that we see and when they're sleep deprived is, if they're really sleep deprived, we'll see them go into REM sleep at an earlier than supposed to. Normally REM sleep should kick in at about, once you fall asleep, should kick in about 80 to 120 minutes, okay? And you should cycle between all your different stages. You should cycle between all your different stages, you know, about every 90 to 120 minutes, and you should cycle through that. But when we see people who are sleep deprived really bad, for whatever reason, psychiatric, sleep disorder breathing, traumatic brain injury, it doesn't matter. If they're really sleep deprived, we see that REM sleep coming on early. And that speaks volumes. And I go, holy cow, you are really sleep deprived. No wonder you say that you're sleepy during the day. And so then we have to investigate those things. And of course, you know, once in a great while, and there has been a little bit of association between this and development later on, but you can develop things like narcolepsy. You know, if you've heard of that. And these people fall asleep at the drop of a hat. These people are more sleepy than patients that have sleep apnea. For example, when we have every patient fill out an Epworth sleepiness scale, and abnormal is 10 or more, and severe I would consider 16 or more. And when they get up to 18 or more on that Epworth sleepiness scale, that rings a red flag in my mind. And I start thinking about things like narcolepsy, and I start thinking about some of these other disorders, because regular sleep apnea, yes, it makes you sleepy, but it doesn't make you sleepy as some of these other disorders. And so those are little cues that we use, and which bring up red flags for us that we can investigate further. But usually your provider will kind of do a broad screen to see if you need a sleep study. Most patients can actually do a home sleep study, okay? The only problem with the home sleep study is there's certain limitations. Number one, with a traditional home sleep study, one of the things you're not looking at is you're not looking at brainwaves. We're looking at other things that we see that when you fall asleep, but we don't look at brainwaves. The definitive way to tell if you've fallen asleep is we got to look at your brainwaves. And that's called a polysomnography. Okay. But if you suspected some type of sleep disorder breathing, you don't necessarily need to see the brainwaves, because we can monitor the flow coming up the nose and the mouth, and we can monitor the heart rate and your chest breathing and stuff like that. And so most people can do a home sleep study. And there are some contraindications for home sleep studies. People that have parasomnias, people that have restless leg syndrome. If you're under 18 years of age, you shouldn't have a home sleep study. And so there are some different factors. But for the most part, most people can have it. If you're at high altitude, like our lab is, we're at 7,000 feet. And high altitude often induces a different type of sleep apnea that we don't see with lowlanders. And so that's a contraindication for us for a home sleep study. So we don't actually, personally in our lab, we don't do very many home sleep studies because we're at such high altitude. But those are different things that we look at, and we can correct those things and kind of go from there. And I hope I'm telling you what you need to know.
Yeah, I believe this is going to be helpful for those listening. So thank you. Now, the last thing I really want to ask you is, what are some things people can do at home? What are some habits? I've heard of sleep hygiene and different things that people can just kind of start where they are, start today once they're done listening to this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For whatever reason, and it's really funny. You would think that people would intuitively know these things, but I'm shocked and amazed at how bad of sleep habits that we develop. When it gets close to bedtime, the average person, you know, goes to bed 9 to 10, 11 o'clock, okay? As it gets close to bedtime, within an hour or two, the first thing that needs to happen is the lights need to be dimmed down in the house. The worst thing that can happen for a sleep disorder is bright lights, okay? So you don't want to go to bed after you've been exposed to all these bright lights, because there's an arousal process there, and it does. Lights have the tendency to either synchronize or change your circadian cycle, your sleep-wake cycle. So if you're going to bed, and then the other bad thing is, are you taking your your phone, and are you reading with it or watching a movie or something like that? The bright lights from that, just from that, is enough to shift your sleep-wake cycle from normal to delay it. And so you might be delayed till 12, 1, 2 o'clock, but yet you think, oh, and this is a common thing that people do, oh, I'm not getting enough sleep, so I'm going to go to bed earlier. Worst thing you could do. We tell patients, in fact, when we bring patients in for sleep studies, within limits, we try to get them as close to their normal sleep time as possible. If you go to bed at 10 o'clock, we try to bring you at 9, because it's going to take us, you know, 30, 40 minutes to get you hooked up. And then by the time we'd gone through all the paperwork and stuff, we got you in bed about the time that you normally go to bed. Patients that have a shift in their cycle, and you can shift it forward or you can shift it backwards. Older people have a tendency to shift forward. Younger adults have a tendency to shift it backwards. So, and you know this, how many young adults do you know? And they're night owls. They like to stay out at night. and then they come in, and that's great for the weekend. But if it's shifted your sleep-wake cycle and you've got to get up in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning and your sleep-wake cycle has shifted, you're going to bed at 9 o'clock and you're laying there awake all night. And then finally about 1 o'clock, you fall asleep. And then you've got to get up at 6 o'clock. You've only had 5 hours of sleep. You're sleep deprived. You definitely have to. You have to affect that. So that's one thing. The other thing that we do is, obviously, when you go to bed, it needs to be dark, cool, and quiet. Okay? Our body temperature begins to drop as we fall asleep. And in fact, in certain stages of sleep, we actually don't regulate body temperature very good at all in REM sleep. And so studies have shown that if your body core temperature begins to drop as you're going to sleep, you actually go into a deeper stage of sleep and you actually feel more restful. So that's something that needs to be taken care of. So kind of a little bit cool, okay? You don't need to have it 80 degrees because it's wintertime and there's 2 foot of snow on the ground. You know, turn the temperature down just a little bit, and you'll do a little bit. Now, obviously, we don't want you getting sick or anything like that, but turn that temperature down. The other thing that we tell patients is no caffeinated beverages after about 12 noon. You can have coffee, you can have tea, you can have sodas, you can have monster drinks, you can have whatever you want up until that time. After that, we don't want you doing it. And the reason being, caffeine interferes, it actually antagonizes a chemical in our body called adenosine. And adenosine is a natural byproduct of cellular metabolism. And as the adenosine levels build up in your system, you get sleepier. Caffeine inhibits that. And it does so for about 6 to 8 hours. Now, some people can metabolize a little bit faster than others, but generally speaking, 6 to 8 hour rule is the rule of thumb. So no caffeine within 6 to 8 hours of bedtime. That's a no-no, okay? I don't know how many people we say, oh, what do you do to go to bed? I drink a cup of coffee. Or I have a soda. Or we've even had people come to the sleep lab, and it cracks me up. They bring in these, you know, a 44-ounce drink and a soda, a Coke or something like that, and they set it on the bedside. I have to have this to sleep at night. And I'm going, no, you don't. This is making my job harder. And so we do that. In the morning, when it's time to wake up, you know, after you've been in bed for 7-8 hours, it's time to get up. Don't linger in bed. Get up. Get up and get exposed to light. The brighter the light, the better. And in fact, we use light therapy to shift patients' circadian cycles, whether they're advanced or whether they're delayed. And so at different times of the day, we can expose these to light and do that. And so those are the basic things that everybody should be doing. Quiet room, dark room, cool temperature, dim lights, and don't expose yourself to bright lights while you're in bed. We tell patients, bed is for two things. Bed is for sleep and sex, okay? We don't want you doing your homework in bed. We don't want you balancing your checkbook in bed. We don't want you on Facebook in bed and typing your story throughout the day. No. Your bedroom is for sleep and sex. That's it, okay? And because sometimes we can actually become psychologically dependent upon some of those other things if we do them enough. And so we want to eliminate those things. Those are the basic things, and that's what we call sleep hygiene. So nothing that's going to stimulate you. And remember, and the other bad thing is alcohol. Alcohol puts people to sleep. It does, but it wakes you up early. So during the night, you'll actually fragment your sleep from the alcohol. So alcohol is a no-no before bedtime, whether it's a martini, whether it's a beer, you know, whatever it is. If you're going to drink any type of alcohol, it needs to be several hours before you go to bed. Alcohol and sleep do not go together. And in fact, in almost every report that we do, we caution them about two things. Alcohol and tobacco will increase sleep disorder breathing, should be avoided. Okay, smoking does that too. So we tell them, don't do those things. People have bad habits and they do those things, but they actually make alcohol and tobacco make sleep disorder breathing worse. And that doesn't matter if you're vaping, you're smoking a cigar, a cigarette, a pipe, or even chewing tobacco. It still gets into the system and it still affects your sleep. Don't do it. So that's the big thing. That's the biggest thing that people can start with, that simple sleep hygiene. And that's going to affect a lot of people.
Thanks for sharing that. You know, I think that the phone thing is something that I know that I have a problem with, and I think a lot of people do, probably especially young adults, like you said, teens, but anyone at any age, we're so used to our phones and we use them as our alarm clocks. So yes, they're on our bedside table. So, you know, I am good at putting it on do not disturb before I go to sleep so that I don't wake up, because I am a light sleeper, which after hearing you speak probably has to do with my autonomic. I have dysautonomia, so it's probably part of that.
Yeah.
So I am good at that, but I mean, I'll be sending my friends texts late at night, you know, just like, you know, how was your day, talking to them over text before I go to bed, and probably not the best idea.
No, it's not a good thing to do. We all do it. Hey, I'm raising my hand. This goes to bed with me. And when I'm bored, you know, I'm looking on Facebook or whatever. I'm guilty.
But for those of us with brain injuries, that we're having such a hard time sleeping. Like I heard you say over and over again throughout this whole conversation that when you sleep better, you heal better. And absolutely. So if we're actively trying to work on our healing from our brain, the best thing we can do is do everything in our power So don't go on your phone. Don't bring it to bed. You know, get an alarm clock or something else that you can use instead of your phone, because we are trying to actively help our brains to heal the best we possibly can.
Yeah,
so
exactly right.
With that said, the final question I always ask all of our guests, this podcast is called Hope Survives Podcast. So what are some final words of hope that you would have for our listeners today?
There's help. There's help. And the body is amazing. The body can heal. I've known this from personal experience. And even to this day, I notice improvement. In my head injury, I was smacked in the head right here. I had a big contusion on my frontal lobe. And initially, I was Mr. Passive. I was super nice when I came into the hospital. And then as that began to heal, as you know, your frontal lobe is where your inhibition centers are and things like that. I got mean. It's really sad, but I did. I got mean, and I had a hard time controlling my emotions and things like that. But in time, as I healed, and my brain injury was, you know, back in 98, and I still think that I'm still healing. And there are things of my life and my personality that I try to work on, and I've noticed a difference. And those things do better, and they will heal. There is help, and your brain and your body can heal itself. Sleep is is part of that big equation, but there's hope, and you do heal. And it's just not for the first 18 months or year or two after you have an injury, which is, yes, where the majority of healing does occur. It occurs over years. So don't give up. If you have a setback, it's okay. We all do. We all do. There's hope.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Wilkins. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast today. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, is there a good way for that?
Sure. The easiest way to get a hold of me is probably, I do have a website. I don't know what it is. Just email me. My email, I'll give you out my email. It's Roy D. Wilkins, WILKINS at hotmail.com. That's probably the easiest thing. And I, because I do teach some postgraduate neurology and stuff, I get emails asking about sleep all the time. In fact, yesterday I commented on an email that came to me about a new device and where it attaches to the tongue and then actually helps sleep apnea. And they wanted to know my opinion on that and things like that. And so I do give my advice about things. And I'll be happy to, unless I just get inundated and have to go incognito or something like that, I try to answer the emails that are directed to me and things like that. And I don't have a problem with that. I'm getting to the tail end of my career. And so I'm slowing down, which means I have more time. I don't spend as much time in the clinic. I probably work less than 10 hours a week, you know, and most of the time I work from my computer, like we're at right now. Most of the time I'm not seeing patients. And so I have a lot more time than I used to. And I don't mind. If you want to send me an email and you have questions, I can answer those questions in email. And once in a while we have to do a phone consult, or I've even had to do telemedicine consults with people that have asked me about different things. And I'm not opposed to doing that, but just contact me through my email first. And then we can go from there, and I can give you some advice if you need to. And I'm not the world's greatest expert on sleep. I can tell you that right now. And I'm not the greatest doctor. There's so much more that people know than I do, but I am a fellow brain injury patient. So been there, done that. And that's all I can tell you.
That's so generous of you. Thank you. I will definitely put your information in the description so that our listeners can view that. So,
okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. And I'll talk to you later.
All righty. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Hope Survives Podcast. I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure to subscribe and stay tuned as more episodes will be coming each week. And check out hopeafterheadinjury.com for more. I'll see you next time. And remember, there's always hope.